You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
It's the beginning of the second quarter of 2021. The first quarter was, I think, interesting to say the least. And in order to look forward, we have to look back. So let's look back and forward with Philip Saunders, the co-head of Multi-Asset Growth at 91 in London. Really, really interesting first 3 months, was it not, Philip?
Yes, Lindsay, and it was plenty of drama. We saw basically the sharpest rise in, 10-year US Treasury yields we've seen for 50 years. And in fact, not that many of us have actually seen that. And the narrative shifted pretty decisively, away from concerns about relapse and multiple waves of COVID sort of destroying the recovery that had been building in over the course of 2020. And we moved decisively to worry about the risk of rising inflation. And, even the expression bond vigilantes was coined again. And I haven't heard that in years.
Yes.
So that was pretty dramatic. Equity markets actually held in pretty well against the background of such a significant rise in long-term interest rates. Normally, when that's going on, equity markets tend to correct. So actually, that was sort of pretty good performance by equities in the circumstances.
The piece that you kindly sent me earlier today says the following. Following the COVID-related plunge, bond yields had been remarkably quiescent throughout the balance of 2020. Last year, this was cited by many as non-confirmation of the recovery. Since then, and I've just been looking at my graph of the US 10-year bond yield, Philip, and this time last year, almost to the day, the US 10-year was yielding 0.76%, and it's now yielding close to 1.76%. Is the market getting ahead of itself? In other words, being too anticipatory of future inflation, or is it actually predicting inflation correctly?
Yeah, well, I think that clearly what was discounted before was a deflationary scenario on the back of obviously the impact of COVID, which, obviously saw, extraordinarily sharp and deep recession globally. But then, actually you saw this V-shaped recovery unfolding. And so therefore, inflation expectations having been far too low have had to adjust. But that large part of that adjustment's actually happened over the course of the last 3 months. Even though there was plenty of evidence to suggest that a pretty strong recovery was underway, led by China initially, and then elsewhere, despite the fact that COVID sort of was causing basically sort of continued lockdowns.
There were some industrial production numbers coming out of, or manufacturing numbers coming out of the Far East this morning, the Korea, Vietnam. China sort of course, led the way, way before other economies did, coming out of the pandemic. But there were some good numbers coming out. Now, will the West follow, do you think? Obviously, albeit as laggards.
Yeah, well, I think that, if you look at the West, then things are going pretty well in the US. So the level of vaccinations basically has been pretty dramatic. And in a way, actually, although Biden is taking the credit for that, actually, it was sort of moves under Trump that basically paved the way for that, sort of shock and awe type response. So things in the US are definitely on the right track. Places like the UK, ditto. Europe sort of, been dropping the ball a bit. But even in Europe, I think that, come the summer, the third wave should be contained and we'll see basically a sort of move towards normalization. So we think that the recovery clearly has legs. It has the potential to be extremely powerful, particularly given the moves to bring in sort of aggressive fiscal policy alongside the sort of kind of unorthodox monetary policy that's been adopted on a huge scale internationally. So as we get into that environment, so if you sort of pan forwards to, the late summer, things should be much more normal then. And economies should be going gangbusters, which of course is good for earnings. It's not particularly great for bond markets, which obviously have the potential to, interest rates have the potential to rise further than that. But then again, the Fed has changed policy and, they want to see a bit of inflation. And so therefore, they're probably going to sit on their hands as far as short-term interest rates are concerned. So conditions are going to remain pretty stimulative, I suspect.
You mentioned two words in your answer to my previous question. One was powerful and the other one is legs, and that's referring to the economy. So when I hear those two words, I automatically think of inflation. At what point does inflation become a little bit of a problem for the Fed and they have to say to themselves they're going to chuck in the towel and actually raise by 25 basis points or 50 basis points? Probably not this year, but at some stage in the future.
Well, the Fed, you know, significantly revised its, reviewed its policy because, you know, they kept getting inflation wrong. They kept basically actually putting rates up too early and by too much. And, you know, the expectations, you know, conventional expectations that inflation would rise were pretty much confounded. So after the global financial crisis in 2008, there was a lot of talk about inflation taking off simply because of unorthodox monetary policies, et cetera. You know, and actually, inflation didn't take off. If anything, it actually sort of declined. And, you know, we saw a cycle that was very extended, but inflation remained sort of extraordinarily low in the circumstances, despite reasonable growth and the longevity of that expansion. Now the Fed, you know, wants to adopt a more what they call a symmetrical policy, which implies that they're happy to allow inflation to overshoot in the short term in order to meet their 2% target, rather than tighten monetary conditions as soon as, you know, economies start to recover, you know, in order to head off sort of inflation. So they've changed. Other central banks tend to actually sort of follow the Fed. So this sort of central bank orthodoxy has sort of shifted, at least in the West, that is. China's a different matter entirely. So generally speaking, you know, central banks want to see a bit of inflation. And I think they'll eventually get it. But that, you know, it might just be a cyclical phenomenon. So we don't think at the moment that there is a risk of a sort of return to the 1970s.
So you don't see the oil price going from $15 a barrel to $65 a barrel, whatever it is at the moment, as being inflationary and dangerously inflationary. You don't see $1.9 trillion of COVID relief from the Biden administration plus $2 trillion of infrastructure spend should it get passed by Congress. You don't see that as being inflation, because you talk about the Fed wanting to see a bit of inflation. How much do they want to see? And crucially, how much do they not want to see?
Well, I think that if inflation sort of was to get back up to, in the US, get back up to about 3%, I think that, you know, they would lean against that, yes, but they wouldn't be too uncomfortable about that. I think if inflation was to sort of start to head north of 3%, then I think that it would be a very different situation. But you've got to bear in mind that there are still some incredibly powerful disinflationary forces at work. You know, technology is going to basically continue to change radically. AI is only really getting going now, and that's going to be hugely disruptive. It's going to reshape whole industries,
yes,
including the financial services industry. And so that is disinflationary, I believe, powerfully disinflationary. Demographics are not really going to
get any
better.
Just before you, sorry to interrupt you, disinflationary because of the efficiencies of,
yes,
a brave new world.
You can do more stuff with fewer people, period.
Mm.
A lot more stuff, which creates all sorts of problems of how do you create employment and all that kind of stuff, or do you have a universal wage or this kind of stuff. So all of that's going to sort of come onto the agenda. But you've still got, you know, intense international competition. You know, okay, wages have gone up in China, but, you know, effectively that's, you know, a lot of the cheap work is sort of moving to places like Bangladesh and Vietnam. So that's sort of continuing. So, you know, you need to see significant wage inflation to really lift inflation to sort of, if you like, sort of scary levels. And I think that we've been positioned with, you know, very little bond exposure. Because we felt that bonds were profoundly misvalued after the COVID plunge in yields. I think looking forwards, you know, real interest rates are still too low, although basically we've now got a bit more of a risk premium in bond yields. But ultimately, we'll need a bit more over the top of that, because inflation is going to sort of average higher than it did over the last 10, 15 years. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to go into a sort of rip-roaring inflationary 70s type period.
Is there a chance, and this is sort of off script here, is there a chance that we'll never see inflation again? I mean, you talk about the 70s, and the 70s was characterised by the oil price shock and all sorts of other things. But will we never see it again, even if the oil price goes to $120 a barrel, and even if there are trillions and trillions of stimulus packages by central banks and authorities in various economies around the world? Do you think, because of the efficiencies, we'll never see inflation again that goes above 2, 2.5, 3%? Is that a reality?
No, I think that you can never say never again. You know, however, if you look at history, inflation was the exception, not the rule. So inflation was normally associated with wars. And you could say that, well, you know, COVID was a war. Well, it's not a conventional war. So inflation tended to go up during wars. Napoleonic Wars, you know, way back in the distant past was an example. Vietnam War, obviously more recently, and so on and so forth. But by and large, you know, actually the gravitational pull of disinflation has remained extremely powerful. So, you know, we don't see that, you know, changing particularly. Sure, at the moment, we're sort of entering new territory in the sense that basically, you know, having relied excessively on unorthodox monetary policies in order to try and sort of boost growth and prevent recessions and so forth and mass unemployment, now basically the fiscal policy is being brought to bear in a much more meaningful way. And so therefore, you've got a highly stimulative environment. And sure, there are going to be areas where prices are pushed up. So, yes. For example, the US is going to build out, presumably, a new smart grid, because basically the electricity grid in the US is sort of antique. That's going to require a lot of copper. And so therefore, the copper price is unlikely to be that weak in those circumstances. So there will be individual prices of commodities that skyrocket, and we've seen that already. But ultimately, to have really embedded inflation, you know, it's not just a monetary phenomenon, you know, which some economists have claimed. You need to basically see wage inflation, if you like, moving up and becoming persistent. And at the moment, basically, there's really little sign of that.
Okay. Looking back at the first quarter of 2021, do you think the second quarter of 2021 will be the noisy neighbour of the first quarter? And if so, do you stand your ground with your asset allocation and your policy? You're the co-head of multi-asset growth at 91. Is there anything that you've seen in the first 3 months of this year that says to you, actually, we ought to shift our asset allocation just a little bit?
Well, I think that, you know, as you know, we've been sort of fairly pro-recovery, pro-growth in terms of our positioning. And for the moment, I see no reason to change that. I think that the whole inflation narrative, which conflated, you know, short-term risks with longer-term risks, got completely overdone, as many market narratives do. And I think from May, we're likely to see sort of headline inflation moderate quite significantly. So I suspect we will, you know, market narratives will move on and we'll find something else to talk about. And bonds might rally a bit. And we'll see maybe a bit of a reversal of the rotation we've seen, you know, because we saw banks performing extremely well. Banks tend to perform well if yield curves are steepening, yeah, which they were doing in the first quarter. So we might see a bit of a correction in that rotational move within equity markets. And, you know, the dollar, basically, coming into the year, you'll remember that, you know, there's almost sort of universal negativity about the dollar, which meant that what should you do? Well, you should buy the dollar. And the dollar has been pretty firm when it was meant to be weak, of course. So I think that basically if the heat goes out of this current rise in long-term interest rates in the U.S., then I think that the dollar strength is likely to ebb somewhat, and that's going to be pretty good for emerging markets in Asia.
Philip Saunders is the co-head of multi-asset growth at 91 in London. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.